Welcome to Lit with Charles, a podcast on all things literary where I interview people who've either written books or have interesting things to say about them. If you're like me, then you love reading, but maybe you're not sure what you should be reading, or maybe you feel intimidated by conversations around books. The main aim of this podcast is to make literature exciting and accessible, and hopefully make you discover new books and authors that are off the beaten track. In this podcast, I try to cover all genres and types of books, from serious historical nonfiction to trashy novels, and I talk to all sorts of authors so that it never feels like the same episode twice.
I think what we need is a grounded, cautious optimism that says, you know what? By comparison to most societies in the history of the world, we're doing pretty damn well. One of the things that I did in researching this book is to really look at what happened to diverse societies across the world.
We live in a changing world with geopolitical forces and academic ideas that are challenging our democratic norms. Extreme politics, both on the right and the left, are very much on the rise in many different countries. Far-right parties have soared across Europe and the US, mainly as a response to new migration movements that reconfigure our liberal democracies to be unprecedentedly diverse. And on the left, we've witnessed, especially in the US, the birth of a new brand of identity politics, which is sometimes referred to as wokeism. That's not a great word, but it'll do for the purposes of this introduction. Both of these extreme forms of politics are undermining our classic democratic norms of universalism, principles that originated with and were enshrined by the American and French revolutions. Today's guest is Dr. Yascha Mounk. He's a German-American political scientist who teaches at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. He's the author of numerous books and articles defending the liberal and universal values of free democratic societies, but today we're going to focus on just two of his books. The first of these two books is called The Great Experiment, which was published last year. In that book, he writes that our modern multicultural societies in the West are under tremendous pressure to integrate these diverse populations in ways that ensure prosperity for all, and most importantly, that manage to maintain our democratic norms. In that book, he outlines some cautiously optimistic policies that government should follow to ensure that multicultural societies can function without falling into common traps that challenge democracy. This year, he's back with a new book that focuses specifically on one of those traps. The book is called The Identity Trap, and in it, he examines the meteoric rise of an ideology which he calls the identity synthesis in the last couple of decades, especially in the United States, from obscure academic environments to mainstream society. In a way, it's a continuation or a companion book to the first book in that they both are connected to the idea that our societies would do well to double down on universalism to deal with our multiculturalism as opposed to focusing on group-based policies. I really enjoyed both his books because they're at just the right intellectual balance between the depth of the ideas and the accessibility of the writing. And he makes these quite complex theoretical discussions come alive. In this episode, we talk about what needs to happen to ensure the success of multicultural democracies. We talk about the origins of the identity synthesis and its development, and how different countries have different models to meet these challenges head on. I hope you enjoy this episode. In the first book, The Great Experiment, you argue that diverse democracies are under stress and will require some policy prescriptions to thrive. And then the second book, The Identity Trap, focuses more on a very specific stress, which you call the identity synthesis, and focuses how that identity synthesis came about. Are there other ways that you think that those two books are connected?
Yeah, I think that they come very much out of the same basic concern, which is that, first of all, our democracies used to be quite stable, used to seem to be quite stable. When I was in graduate school, I was told that countries like the United States or the United Kingdom or France really didn't have to worry about their democratic future because they were, quote unquote, consolidated. And secondly, one of the big questions about the future stability is the huge amounts of demographic and cultural change that we've lived through for the last decades, which is part of what has allowed far-right populists and others to thrive and to challenge those institutions. And so in different ways, what both of these books, The Great Experiment and The Identity Trap, are doing is to defend and develop one kind of vision for the sort of society in which I think we should live. And that is one in which we're less rather than more defined by the kinds of groups into which we're born, in which we resist what the right wants to do, which is to give some people second-class status or to exclude them from society, to mistreat them because they're not part of the quote-unquote true people, because they're not part of a historically dominant or native group in a country, but also to resist what I see as a big temptation among many of my friends and colleagues, namely to say that the only way to overcome historic injustice, which is undoubtedly real and undoubtedly persists, is to actually double down on identity groups, to make how we treat each other and how the state treats us in social situations, in public policy, in all kinds of contexts, more and more dependent on the kind of group of which we're a part. I think what we need to do is to live up to the universal principles enshrined in the United States Constitution, promulgated by the French Revolution, the basic ideals of liberal democracies around the world, recognizing that we've often failed to live up to them, but promising to do better, promising to actually live up to them more fully. And that, I think, is the concern that these two books share.
The first book, The Great Experiment, got its title, I think, from an interview you were giving, or you were on a panel, and you mentioned those words, and you came under fire, I think, for using that expression, or you found unlikely support, I think, from far-right groups that said, you see, it's an experiment. How did you think of the word experiment? Why do you use that word?
Yeah, so this was an interview with a big German television show called Tagesthemen, one of the main news shows in the country, and I was asked about the reasons for the rise of populism, which I'm very concerned about. And I said it has to do with social media and the way it makes it easier for people to spread hatred and misinformation. I said it has to do with economic stagnation of living standards for many citizens who don't look towards the future with the same optimism than the parents or grandparents may have done. But it also has to do with the rapid demographic transformation in many democracies. You know, when you look at a country like Sweden or Germany, they used to be comparatively homogeneous 40 or 50 years ago, and now have a very high share of people who are born outside the country, often in different continents and so on. And I said, this is going to create some problems. It's a historically unique experiment. We don't quite have a clear precedent for it, but I think it can and it will succeed. And I thought the interview had gone fine. My mom, who's always critical of my interviews, called me to tell me I'd done great. You know, I switched off the phone and flew to the United States. And when I woke up and switched on the phone on arrival, there's all of these messages. I mean, my phone was just blowing up. And I thought, oh my God, something's happened. And the interview had gone viral on these far-right blogs. And then these German far-right politicians were talking about it. And quickly it made it to a news story of a lovely American website called The Daily Stormer, a neo-Nazi website. And it's amazing to what extent I'm still getting messages about this. So to this day, I have Google alerts in which, you know, somebody is quoting those words to show that this political scientist who used to teach at Harvard and so on is, you know, admitting to experimenting on the German people in Diek with, you know, Angela Merkel or somebody. And of course, what I meant is not an experiment like a chemistry teacher in high school pours one liquid into another, and when there's a little explosion, and hopefully he's really thought about what he's done, and the school doesn't blow up. It's an experiment in the sense that the American founders talked about the great experiment of the American Republic. It's an experiment in the sense of actually quite inadvertently, in this case, ending up in a situation that's unprecedented, for which we don't know the rules, we don't quite know how it's going to work, and we have to make the best of it. We have to make it stick. And so that's really what I think through in my work. What kind of rules and norms and ideals do we need to make these societies that already are deeply diverse and that could only become more homogeneous by the most abject cruelty and violence and war? How do we make them work? How do we learn to live together in a really productive, thriving, optimistic fashion?
Optimistic is a word that I would use to describe your vision for the success of The Great Experiment. Can you recap for our listeners what you think these diverse democracies need to do in order for this great experiment to be sustainably successful? What are some of the metrics that you would use to measure success? Take us through a little bit your view on that.
Yeah, so first of all, I think actually becoming more optimistic is itself very important, very productive. What I've seen in many elections recently is that voters are asked to choose between a pessimist on the far right who blames newcomers and outsiders for everything that's wrong in their country, or often a more mainstream pessimism that says our countries are so deeply irredeemable and unjust that there's just no real hope for how we can build a better future, and so we should self-castigate. And it's unsurprising that a lot of voters then choose to blame others rather than themselves. I think what we need is a grounded, cautious optimism that says, you know what, by comparison to most societies in the history of the world, we're doing pretty damn well. One of the things that I did in researching this book is to really look at what happened to diverse societies across the world. And there's many sources of human conflict, but often things like ethnicity, race, religion, nationality, language, have caused just terrible forms of war and ethnic cleansing. Mm. And today, these really diverse societies from the United States to Canada to Britain to France and Germany and so on have real problems and real injustices, and we have to be very clear-eyed about them. But it's striking how comparatively peaceful and tolerant and prosperous and thriving they are. And you see that in the debate about something like immigration, where you know a lot of the far right is saying, oh, well, you know, these immigrants are doing terribly because supposedly, I'm quoting here, right, there's something inferior about them, either culturally or perhaps even biologically, right? That's why they're not succeeding. And then you have a lot of people more on the mainstream, more on the left, who say, well, it's true, these immigrants are doing terribly, and it's because we are so unfair and unjust and racist and terrible. And you know, that second explanation comes closer to the mark than the first, but undoubtedly are structural injustices and inequalities in our society that make it harder for newcomers to succeed. But actually, the best studies that we have with over 1 million data points show that in the United States, for example, the children and grandchildren of immigrants today from Central America and Vietnam and Nigeria and all over the world are doing as well as immigrants from Italy and Ireland did 100 years ago. It takes a while for people to rise the socioeconomic ranks, especially in the first generation when people didn't have many educational opportunities in the countries that they are from sometimes. But that process of socioeconomic advantage is actually really working and really happening. And I think recognizing that should make us less afraid of where our society is headed and more able to defend the aspects of our society that are in fact positive.
One of the aspects of society which you, I think, see as a threat to this universalist approach to succeeding here is this identity synthesis, which you write about in the second book. The second book, therefore, by definition, because it's highlighting a threat, felt much more pessimistic, I think, than the first. So what does the sequence of these two books tell us about your thinking? Have you become more pessimistic about the chances of the success of diverse democracies than you were when you wrote the first book? How has your thinking evolved in the last few years?
Oh, that's interesting. You know, I have a first big book that I wrote called The People Versus Democracy. I like to say that I'm a democracy crisis hipster. I was worried about threats to democracy before it was cool. Then people really saw me as the ultimate pessimist because I was sort of warning about the fact that democracy in a country like the United States might come to be a threat at a time when people didn't believe that yet. So I was known as a real pessimist when I wrote this book, The Great Experiment, which I think rightly was read as being much more optimistic, which emphasized that if we stick to the philosophical principles of liberalism and celebrate a positive and inclusive form of patriotism, if we actually have a right guiding metaphor for the kind of way we should live together, build not on the melting pot and not on the salad bowl, but on the idea of a public park that we share as a space and so on, then we can actually make it work. And so now it's interesting, sort of you're right that in a way the new book sounds more pessimistic again, because I'm saying, hey, a lot of the ideas that my best friends, that my close colleagues have claim to be pursuing a good destination, are motivated by genuine injustices, see themselves as the most a radical fight for equality, for fairness, for justice. But the problem with them, I argue, is not that they're going too far in the right direction. It's hard to see how one could go too far in the right direction. It's that they really are aiming in the wrong direction. It's that rather than envisioning a society in which we're very aware of the persistent injustices and do everything we can to overcome them, but actually move towards being in closer contact with each other, having deeper solidarity with each other, more cultural exchange, building a world in which how we treat each other is less dependent on the group in which we're from. It's actually oddly conservative in a way. It wants to really define everybody by the group into which they were born. And it wants to reject what I regard as the most noble and inspiring political tradition in the United States, that which ran from Frederick Douglass through Martin Luther King to somebody like Barack Obama, all of whom were deeply aware of the hypocrisies of the times, of the injustices of the times, but insisted, as Frederick Douglass would have said, not to rip up the Constitution, but to make sure that African Americans and other minority groups were included in them, were granted the same protections than everybody else. And so I don't think that, despite appearances, my levels of optimism or pessimism have fluctuated that much over the last 10 years. I think my basic stance is sort of reads differently depending on the topic I tackle. But I basically think that we've made tremendous progress over the last 200, over the last 100, or over the last 50 years. But our reality is imperfect and unjust, and that what it is to believe in these principles is to always want to live up to them more fully, is to always be angry at the injustices that persist. But the best way of doing that is not to rip those principles up. It's to defend our basic institutions and our basic principles and exhort all of us to actually live up to them. And so I think there's always a set of risks that I'm very concerned about, that I think we need to vanquish, but also a lot of reason to be optimistic that we might succeed in doing that. So I wouldn't actually say that my optimism or pessimism has fluctuated. I think there is a good future available for us. We just have to choose it and fight for it.
In The Identity Trap, I think one of my favorite bits of the book was when you trace the genealogical tree for the identity synthesis. I found that really fascinating. And I was wondering if you might take a few minutes now to run our listeners through the major milestones in that evolution, starting with the collapse of universalism, the rise of postmodern thought. And it was just so interesting the way you built those milestones.
Yeah, so in the debate today, it's become very common to say nobody can define a term like wokeness. And I avoid using the term woke because I think it's just become too charged and not very useful. And it's true that a lot of people who rail against anything they consider woke don't really understand those ideas and aren't capable of giving a subtle rendering of them. But I do think that it's possible to show both the main themes and really the principal driving principles of this new ideology that has come to have tremendous influence over social and cultural life in the United States and many other Anglo-Saxon countries and even beyond over the course of the last 10 years, the ideology that I call the identity synthesis. And so what I do in my new book, in The Identity Trap, is four things. I trace, and I'm an intellectual historian by training in part, I trace the origins of those ideas in these major post-war thinkers. I explain how these ideas went from being pretty influential in universities by about 2010, but marginal to society as a whole, to having tremendous pull over mainstream institutions and politics in America by 2020. I offer serious, level-headed critique of the main applications of these ideas to areas from whether we can understand each other across the boundaries of race and gender and sexual orientation to cultural appropriation to free speech. And finally, I offer a defense of a more humanist, more universalist outlook that can take injustices seriously without throwing the baby out with the bathwater. So to go to the first point, you know, what actually is this set of ideas and where does it come from? How does that help us explain what some people would call wokeness or what I would call the identity synthesis actually is? I think the starting point is with Michel Foucault and postmodern, later post-structuralist thought in post-war Paris. Foucault was really motivated by rejecting what he called the grand narratives that structured the way that many of his interlocutors understood the world. One of those was Marxism, which he rejected, the idea that we have this inexorable law of history that explains where things are headed and that puts people into these clear categories like proletarians and so on and bourgeoisie. The other idea that Foucault rejected was liberalism, the core ideals of our liberal democracies. He thought that was suspect for the same reasons. And so what comes from that...
Seems like he was rejecting a lot of things.
He was rejecting a lot of things. And when I interviewed Noam Chomsky on my podcast a year and a half ago, about 50 years after Chomsky had a debate with Foucault on Dutch television, he said Foucault was the most amoral, not immoral, but the most amoral person that he'd ever met. He was shocked by the fact that for Foucault, it was unclear how to bring about political progress. And part of that reason for that was a second point that Foucault makes about how political discourses work. He said that power doesn't really flow from the top down, as you or I might think naively, right? It's not sort of the president who passes some edict and then the police enforces it and so on. That might be part of it, but really power inheres in these cultural discourses and the way that you and I talk, the concepts we use, and the way we think about the world. That's one of the reasons why he was very skeptical of identity categories. So in our terms, Foucault was gay, but he didn't like the idea of being gay or being a homosexual. He thought that was too narrowing of a variety of sexual experiences, and he rejected that label. And so he thought that, you know, if you disturb one discourse, that might lead to this brief moment of freedom, but then there's the next discourse that immediately snaps shut, and it's actually going to be as oppressive as the other. So I think today's ideology takes from Foucault is two things, which is the skepticism towards universal or general or objective truth, and this emphasis on political discourse. And then in the next step, you have the rise of a post-colonial tradition. And Edward Said, Palestinian-American thinker and literary critic, really takes on the mantle of thinking about discourses. But what he says is, look, the discourse of Orientalism, of how people in the West have fought about the East, has really helped to justify colonial oppression in the past. But that's not enough. Pointing that out is interesting and so on, but that's not enough. I actually want to do something with that knowledge. I want to change and flip discourses in such a way that we empower those who've been disempowered in the past. So he coins a kind of politicized form of discourse analysis that comes to be quite influential today. You know, today when you do feminist politics, let's say, part of that might be, you know, fighting for abortion rights or for certain kinds of laws about equal pay. But a lot of it is going to be, you know, critiquing the Barbie movie or critiquing how women are represented in social and cultural discourses. We've come to think of that as a key tool of political battle. And that really comes from Foucault and Said. And then the next step in the post-colonial tradition is Gayatri Spivak, a literary theorist who teaches in comparative literature at Columbia University for many years. She was born and raised in Kolkata, in Bengal, in India, a very poor city. And she is deeply influenced by postmodern thinkers like Foucault. And she kind of shares with them this idea that these essentialist definitions of what your identity is, saying, you know, because you're gay or black or whatever, that really is something essential about you, that tells you something meaningful about you. Those are problematic. She thinks philosophically, we can't quite justify them. But she rejects the idea that Foucault and others have of, therefore, we can't speak for others. Therefore, I can't speak on behalf of a proletariat, as Marxists wanted me to do. She says the subaltern in the third world, the kind of people in the streets of Kolkata who may not have had a chance to go to school, they can't speak for themselves. Somebody has to speak for them. And to speak for them, we have to speak in identity categories. We have to encourage them to define by their identity so that they can go and rise up against marginalization and injustice that they experience. So she coins this interesting, strange, very influential term of strategic essentialism. And what she means by that is that philosophically, these essentialist accounts of identity are wrong, are mistaken. But for strategic purposes, we have to act as though they were true. We have to encourage people to see themselves as part of these groups, and we can speak on their behalf. And that becomes really influential today. For example, in the field of education, I'm really struck by the way in which many elite private schools in the United States, and increasingly within narrow legal limits, even some public schools, are separating kids out by their race. Many of the most elite schools in the country now have teachers who come into first or second grade classrooms and tell these kids, if you're white, you go over there. If you're Latino, you go over there. If you're Asian American, you go over there. If you're black, you go over there. And then they try to encourage in them the right kind of self-identification as, quote unquote, a racial being. One of the most influential consultancies in the educational space now is called Embrace Race. And this really comes out of this idea of strategic essentialism. And I think it's a mistake, right? And then the third step, I know this is, you know, it takes a while to go through this history, but I think it's really illuminating. And the third step, you have a rise of critical race theory, which is also influenced by these ideas that came before. It sort of originally is located within what's called critical legal studies, a postmodern approach to the law in American law schools. And the key move here is twofold. First, Derrick Bell, really interesting African-American lawyer and legal theorist, who was heroically doing work for the NAACP throughout the 60s, desegregating schools and businesses and other institutions throughout the American South, comes to think of much of that work as a mistake. He comes to say, you know what, there's this conservative critique that people make of us civil rights lawyers, but we're not really fighting for the interests of our clients. We just have this ideology of desegregation. And they're kind of right, because a lot of the time the clients we argue for, you know, their kids might have graduated high school by the time they're integrated. And those high schools might not end up being very good. And that part of the critique is fair. But he then comes to this conclusion, which was controversial at the time, and I think rightly controversial, that actually perhaps what we need to do is to often have schools that are separate but truly equal. But perhaps Brown versus Board of Education was in some key ways a mistake. That we're never going to get equal treatment under the same laws, and perhaps therefore we need to make how people are treated much more explicitly dependent on the kind of group that we're from.
It's a sort of resegregation, as you were just describing.
It is. And, you know, one of the things that in the discourse today I sometimes find frustrating is that on the right, people say anything is woke that they happen not to like, right? So for some, you know, far-right polemicists, you know, if you teach people about slavery in school, that's somehow woke, right? But then on the left, as a result, there's come to be this misunderstanding that really this ideology is just common sense things that we should all agree. And the people who would be most perturbed by that, most offended by that, are the founders of that ideology, right? Derrick Bell mocked We Shall Overcome, the famous song of the civil rights movement, as, you know, fake piety, basically. He said, I quote, "But we have to reject the defunct racial equality ideology of the civil rights movement." Somebody like Kimberly Crenshaw, another really important figure in this movement, said that the ideas of Barack Obama were fundamentally at odds with critical race theory. So this is not just a movement that's saying, you know, let's be critically open, critically aware about the role that race plays in America today. Many people are aware of that. They really want to go far beyond that. So in the case of Bell, that means reject any form of universal value or neutral law. We have to make how people are treated much more explicitly dependent on the group they're from. Reject the idea that there might be any kind of progress in America. For Bell, when he passed away in the early 2000s, America was as racist as it had been in 1950 or in 1850. And then later in Kimberly Crenshaw, that is a description of what she calls intersectionality, which is straightforward and sensible, but sometimes the kind of discrimination you experience is not just an additive value of the different identities you have, but something beyond that. So, you know, the experience of discrimination that Black women have might be more than the sum of the experience that white women and Black men have. That makes sense. The idea of intersectionality then sort of runs away and often starts to mean that if you stand at a different intersection of identities than I do, I will just never be able to understand you. And instead of trying to be in conversation with you, trying to really understand you, you should just defer judgment and say, hey, I'll never understand you, so I'll get with your demands, but I really don't know what it is that you're saying. And so you take those ideas together, the rejection of truth in Foucault, the emphasis on this politicized form of discourse analysis and the embrace of strategic essentialism in the postcolonial tradition, the rejection of universalism and the embrace of this deep pessimism about, you know, racism and other forms of bigotry being permanent, and the sort of more extreme version of intersectionality. Those are some of the main themes of what we see on social media and in public debates today. And, you know, many of the thinkers I described, I've learned from and I think are smart, interesting people. I have fundamental disagreements with them, but they're people I respect. Of course, often the way those ideas then play out today are in a sort of popularized, vulgarized form that I think is less subtle and therefore even more damaging.
What's incredible is that some of these thinkers like Derrick Bell and Kimberly Crenshaw were relatively new thinkers. And so it's astounding how quickly those ideas went from academic ivory towers to the mainstream, albeit in a popularized, vulgarized way, as you just said. And you describe that process pretty deeply in your book. Can you take us through essentially how these ideas were amplified so quickly?
So there's a really interesting article by Kimberly Crenshaw, who actually coins the term critical race theory on the 20th anniversary of a conference that really coins that term and officially founds the tradition. And she basically says, look, it's amazing what influence we've had in academia and in law schools, and we have good jobs and lots of people are working on this stuff. This is all great. But we're never going to have real influence in the mainstream, right? This is no hope. And then over the course of 10 years, you know, these ideas come to have this tremendous influence. And actually, these, I think, less subtle thinkers like Robin DiAngelo and Ibram X. Kendi, who really are sort of the popularizers of some of these ideas, are at the top of bestseller lists. Mm. They run corporate trainings for the Coca-Cola company. Public policy becomes to be deeply influenced by the precepts of some of these ideas. Mm. And so how does that happen? Well, I think there's a few answers. One is what I'm calling the short march through the institutions, which is not a conspiracy theory. It's not a deliberate act. But a lot of, you know, young, talented students who are steeped in these ideas at their high schools and at their elite colleges come into the workplace and spread those ideas. They've come into contact with these ideas in humanities and social science courses, if they're majors, in distribution requirements, even if they're doing something like engineering, and particularly through the role of administrators on campus, who are much more far left and much less liberal, much more hostile to free speech, for example, than faculty members. And they really help to set the culture on campus more and more, because they've started to outnumber faculty members like myself. And you see this particularly in institutions that hire a lot of young people from elite institutions and that have self-conception as serving the good in the world. So your nonprofit organizations like the ACLU, companies like Google, a lot of professional firms, that's really where the first impact of that hits. So that's one set of developments. Another set of developments has to do with the role of social media and the way in which it emphasizes forms of identity. You know, a key early player here is Tumblr, more so than Twitter or Facebook. And what Tumblr allowed mostly teenage users to do is to self-tag by a form of identity. And that really changes the game. Because if you're in high school, and you want, you know, you're 15, 16, you're searching for an identity, you only really have available the identities that exist within your school, because you need a certain number of people to share an identity for it to be viable. And that's just a numeric limit, right? On Tumblr, you can sort of play with identities, play with terms, tag something, find a group of 20 people anywhere in the world, and you can sort of really start to build that identity. So that's where ideas like demisexual or new gender identities like Libra gender and so on, they all start on Tumblr. And then you need an ideology to hold those ideas together, to broker between them. And that starts to be this idea that you have to defer to each other, that you can never offend anybody, that everybody owns sort of their own corner of the world that is mediated by their identity. It starts to take on the written form on websites like Ford Catalog, be repackaged in more viral form on websites like everydayfeminism.com, that has headlines like, you know, six things you should tell your yoga teacher who thinks that cultural appropriation is okay, or, you know, those kinds of like BuzzFeed-style versions of the popularized form of identity synthesis. And then you have a transformation in how content spreads in social, in publishing, from people going to landing pages of websites and clicking on things that interest them, which means you have to cater to a broad audience, to everything spreading through social media networks where people are connected to others who share an ascriptive identity. And so suddenly you can have much more first-person stuff that only speaks to a subsection of your usual readers, but that spreads in those kinds of networks. And then there's an economic crisis in the New York Times and the Washington Post who desperately need clicks. And so they hire writers who really specialize in these kinds of things. And so within the course of 10 years, you have this huge transformation, visibility of these ideas in the public spheres. Even before Donald Trump is elected, ideas like microaggression just skyrocket in how often they're used in places like the New York Times and MSNBC and CNN and the Washington Post. And then Trump is elected. And one of the really interesting things I found in doing this, the research for this book, is the role of in-group critics. That normally, you know, if you're part of a group and somebody who's been part of a group for a long time says, hey, I think we may be making a mistake here. Perhaps something we've started to do is a little bit off. You're going to listen to them. You're going to give them the benefit of a doubt with a well-intentioned, unless there's a condition of threat, unless people think, hey, we are threatened from the outside. And then these in-group critics are viewed as traitors, are expelled, are often treated worse than out-group critics, critics who are not part of a group. And that is the dynamic that I see in many of my own social contacts starting to happen after 2016. People rightly feel threatened about the election of Donald Trump. They're rightly concerned about it. They have no power over Trump. They don't manage to impeach him, to get him out of office. But what we do have power over is the moral purity of the own community. And so anybody who starts to express doubts about this new ideology in any way comes to be seen as a traitor. And you have all of these internal meltdowns in institutions with the fights that leads to.
So he crystallized a little bit those movements and purified them to their essential core, as it were.
And it makes disagreement explicitly taboo. And the two thinkers I mentioned, D'Angelo and Kendi, play a key role in that. D'Angelo says, if you disagree with any of those ideas, that's just a case of white fragility, right? It's just because you're insufficiently strong to be able to have self-criticism. You're just trying to defend yourself. And Kendi says that what he defines as anti-racist, he thinks, by the way, that to be anti-racist, you have to reject the American Constitution. And anybody who's not anti-racist is a racist. There's no such thing as being not racist. So unless you agree to scratch your constitution, you're a racist. And so you take those two ideas together and it basically becomes a non-falsifiable theory. Any attempt to try and argue against it just gets you branded as, you know, being on the side of the worst, you know, racists and white supremacists in society. You know, there's a great paper by an anthropologist in the 1990s with a lovely title, How Come That the Enemy of Humanity Always Turns Out to Be the Guy in the Office Down the Hall? And there's something about that dynamic. Rather than focusing on the real threat from all of the far-right populists who are trying to undermine our institutions and generally don't want forms of thriving, diverse democracies, we start to direct it against people who say, well, perhaps actually we should stay in the tradition of people like Douglas and King and Obama and try to live up to what's best in our constitution rather than scrapping it. Suddenly, if you say that, you know, you're seen as a traitor.
So in both books, you argue for universalism or the principles of universalism to drive us to a post-race society. And I want to give you two examples and see how you think of them. The first example I would say is France, where universalism, even more so than the US, is one of the cornerstones of the state. The government cannot make or measure policy according to ethnic or religious lines. That maybe has a tendency to mask underlying issues of injustice and unequal treatment according to ethnic or religious lines. So I guess the first question would be around, what is France doing wrong? And is France too far along in the principles of universalism? The second example I want to give you is a country where I lived for 7 years, which is Singapore. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but Singapore was created under conditions of massive ethnic conflict in the late 50s. And so the Singaporean government's really quite paranoid about anything that might threaten the balance and the diversity of Singapore. And so in public housing in Singapore, the government has quotas to say that if there are three apartments on a certain floor, then they have to be broken up by ethnicity. So there will be one apartment for a Chinese family, one apartment for a Malay family, one apartment for an Indian family, to really force that integration. But it's very tightly measured and the quotas are really very strictly enforced, which to me is really a case of identifying people according to their ethnic group and, you know, crunching everybody together to ensure exposure to each other and so on. What, in your opinion, works well in either of those two models? What doesn't work well?
Yeah, this is a great question. Thank you. Just to clarify, I don't use the term post-racial and I don't use it for a reason. I think in, you know, a hugely diverse society, people will always have all kinds of grounds of what they identify themselves by. And some will choose to give, you know, great importance, certainly to the cultural origin, to the national origin, and perhaps to some extent to the race. Especially, you know, for a group like African Americans who've been defined by the race for so long. And that is fine. I have no problem with that. I have no problem with, you know, even 16, 17-year-olds in high schools choosing to be part of a cultural club that is organized around some of these lines, for example. I think the question is, in which direction should society be pushing? And precisely because, as I explain in The Great Experiment and in The Identity Trap, our natural tendency is towards really going towards those subnational groups and saying, what defines me is what makes me different from you. What we need is institutions that encourage dialogue and friendship between those groups rather than institutions that push them apart. And many, in many cases in the United States now, we're going in the wrong direction with that. It's one thing to allow 16-year-olds who have a lot of their own agency to say, hey, I want to hang out with these people and perhaps part of what makes us similar is our racial background. That's one thing. It's another thing for a teacher to come in when the kids are six and say, part of my educational mission is to give you the right racial self-identification. And my goal is to teach you that the most important thing about you is that you're black or brown or Asian American or white, right? I mean, this is the most absurd thing that now happens. They then put these white kids into one group and lecture them about, you know, white privilege and so on. I'm not afraid that these kids are going to sort of have a hard hour. It's fine to deal with hard questions, even for young kids. But everything I know from social psychology and from history is that when you tell people the most important thing about you is that you're white, as one really progressive school on the Upper West Side of Manhattan tells people, you know, these kids should embrace their whiteness. That's not going to make anti-racists. That's going to make racists, right? So I think that is a very, very big mistake. So let me deal with these two big questions that you're putting on the table. So one is, we must, of course, be deeply attuned and aware of what kind of injustices are present in our society. And of course, one of the ways in which people are discriminated against in the United States today, for example, is race. And so we must be aware of that, and we must take action against that. So we certainly shouldn't be race blind in the sense of ignoring the ways in which race currently structures our reality. The question is what kind of society we should be building and what kind of society we should be aiming for. Is the right remedy to then make how people are treated by the state explicitly depend on how, you know, which race they belong to? And even in our mutual treatment, you know, somebody like Robin DiAngelo says that every time a white person interrupts a black person, they're bringing the whole apparatus of white supremacy to bear on them. That might be true in certain contexts, but there might also be two buddies who are friends who love to argue about politics, who are white and black, and they interrupt each other all the damn time. Like, we've interrupted each other a few times in this podcast. There might be lovers. There might be people who are married who just sometimes get impatient with each other. That's not bringing the whole apparatus of white supremacy to bear with each other. It actually makes me think that Robin DiAngelo doesn't have any black friends and that her kind of social norms would make it hard for people to be friends across those kind of racial lines. So that's the wrong way of solving this. So when I look at the United States, I think we often don't measure for class in social science, for example, in many contexts, just measure for race. And then we ascribe to race things that are actually explained by social class. France has the inverse problem. France never measures race, and so then they ascribe to class things that often actually have to do with race. The right approach is not to have a monomaniacal view where you can only think about one category. It's to think about both and to investigate empirically which of these factors is more important in what context. And that answer is going to vary depending on, you know, what question, what country, what time period, and so on you're thinking about. The question about Singapore is super interesting as well. I was in Singapore for the first time in the spring. It's a very impressive place, if also in some ways somewhat disturbing one. You know, I think that I have a lot of sympathy for that strand of Singaporean public policy. The question of saying, hey, how do we make sure in this multi-ethnic society that we don't have deep forms of segregation? But the particular way in which Singapore has chosen to pursue that goal, particularly in the context of public housing, can be a little bit ironic. You know, the goal is that we don't want one, you know, neighborhood of Singapore that's all Malay, and one neighborhood that's all Chinese origin, one neighborhood that's all Indian origin. And that's a very worthy goal. But of course, if you say, hey, you're only, you know, there has to be a certain percentage of housing within each housing block from each of the ethnic groups, then if you're Indian, for example, and that's one of the smallest ethnic groups in Singapore, you can only sell to other Indians. So actually, in a bizarre way, you might have neighbors who are parts of different groups, and that's positive, but you're deeply defined in how you're treated by that ethnic origin, right? And so I think there's something slightly perverse and paradoxical about the way in which that policy plays out. But let me give you one example about the United States on that, right? As somebody who didn't go to college in the United States, I always find it slightly cruel and unusual that American college kids have to share a literal room in the first year. But I think the nice thing that comes out of that is genuine friendships of people who are very different from you. And for a long time, if you'd go to one of those colleges, you'd be assigned a roommate. And often they wanted to assign you a roommate who's different from you. That was part of a goal. Well, now many elite universities in the United States are proactively building dorms that are separated, that are reserved for African-Americans or for Latinos. And they often encourage students to choose to live in those dorms. More broadly, they allow people to request roommates that often they've met on groups on, you know, Facebook or some other social media platform. And those obviously end up being much more similar to them, right? Because they probably have similar backgrounds and geographical origins and often ethnic origins. I think that's a mistake, right? Here's just a way in which we've had this long tradition of making people live in close proximity to each other across those differences. And some really important lifelong friendships have come out of that. real mutual understanding, real mutual communication, sometimes through conflict as well, sometimes in frustration at 2 a.m., but in ways that I think are really meaningful and helpful. I think giving up on those kind of traditions that already existed is a really big mistake and one of the small ways in which these ideas can lead us astray.
What subjects are you currently seeing now that you've just finished this book, The Identity Trap? What subjects are you seeing on the horizon in the news that you find potentially inspiring for any future book projects? What are you thinking of for your next one? There seems to be a very clear, logical evolution in your work. So what's the next step?
Well, let me say two things about that. I mean, one is that I'm going to have published two books in the span of 18 months. And, you know, some people who write thrillers and so on are able to sustain that for a lifetime. I'm not. So I'm in no great rush to write the next book. And I'm really proud of this new book, The Identity Trap. And I really want to make sure that people understand its arguments and so on. I have two goals for this book. I mean, one is to help people make better arguments against these ideas, because I think the arguments that are out there so far are often just polemical and simplistic.
Well, and they originate from the Trump wing of the Republican Party, I imagine. That's really where those arguments come from.
Well, not exclusively, and I don't know whether they originate there necessarily, but they've certainly been sort of, you know, they're trying to appropriate some of those ideas, and I'm of course conscious of that. And the second goal is to actually convince people who are on the fence. I think that's a lot of people, it's a lot of my friends who feel, hey, I'm deeply aware of the injustices in our society, and I think we must fight against them. And this ideology promises us to do that, but is it actually doing that? You know, they also are starting to see some things that disturb them, some of the ways in which these ideas are playing out that don't seem to be making society better, that perhaps are tearing organizations in which they've been a part. Or, you know, they say, hey, you know, I agree that there's been ways in which white artists have stolen from black artists, but should we put, you know, mutual cultural exchange and a general pole of suspicion, like the concept of cultural appropriation does, perhaps that's going a little bit too far. And so I want to reach people who are torn in this way. And so I'm happy to spend some time, you know, having conversations like this to facilitate that. The second thing I'll say is, you know, I certainly don't want to become a lifelong crusader against these ideas. This is the one damn book I've written about this topic. I'm proud of it. I put a lot of work in it. I really hope people will read it. But the next book is certainly going to be on a different subject. And I don't know what that is. I've been thinking a lot lately. I was traveling a lot in Asia after finishing this book in the spring. And I have roots in Europe, of course, and spent a lot of time in Italy. And I'm struck by how societies that are as different as, you know, Italy and Japan and South Korea and China and increasingly the United States and Mexico have a real crisis of population. They really are failing to
replace their dying populations.
Yeah, they struggle to reach the levels of fertility they need to sustain their welfare state and their pension systems and the cultural dynamism and all the good things that come with kids. And it's a personal struggle for people, right? They feel so torn between wanting to have kids often and needing to make their professional advancement in the late 20s and 30s. And you know, I don't know. I think that's an interesting topic. I don't know if I'll end up writing a book about it, but I've been thinking about it of late.
I think it's time for our quick question section where I ask you about your literary preferences. What's your favorite book that I probably haven't heard of?
Well, you know, let me answer slightly differently. There's a book that I have heard of and that you may well have heard of that I hadn't read and that I think very few people have read. And it's called Darkness at Noon by Arthur Koestler.
I have read it. It's an excellent book.
It is really good. And there's a new translation of it. All That Existed, it was written in great haste in the 1930s. And All That Existed was a very bad, hasty English translation. Even a German edition used to be for many decades a retranslation from the English. But it really is a deep study of how people come to participate in and justify to themselves the ravages of totalitarianism. And I found it to be actually more insightful and more moving than another classic in that genre, which is The Captive Mind by Czesław Miłosz.
Both great books. And I think the Darkness at Noon book is a great example of where sometimes these extreme ideologies can end up taking us and eating their young, as it were, with very unintended consequences. What's your favorite book that you just cannot recommend to your friends?
I've spent a reasonable amount of time in India, and I have many friends in India. And there is a super best-selling Indian author that all of those sort of high-minded friends of mine look down on called Chetan Bhagat. And, you know, while I was in India, I walked to a bookstore and I looked at the bestseller list, you know, and like 7 out of the 10 top books at the time were written by Chetan Bhagat. And I thought, you know, I should read one of those books. And I did. It's a book called, the best-selling book at the time, I think was his latest one, was called The Half-Girlfriend. It is not great literature. My friends were all horrified that I was reading this. But it taught me more about India sociologically and socioeconomically than a lot of other things that I encountered. It really tells the story of a sort of lower middle class guy from a poor province of India who comes to Delhi and makes his way and needs to learn how to treat people right, needs to learn how to speak English, but sort of undergoes the social evolution and then finally wins over the half-girlfriend in the title. Not the best book I've ever read, but a book that taught me a tremendous amount about India and genuinely shocked my friends when I was reading it.
What's the best book that you've read in the last 12 months?
You know, I had a great pleasure a little while ago to teach a seminar about George Orwell. Mm-hmm. I really just love Orwell. I think that there's so much subtlety in all of his work. And while people, you know, have normally read Animal Farm in high school and perhaps have read 1984, his essays still remain underappreciated. People know about them, but I don't think that many people have read them. And so I've just found myself as I was preparing to teach this course and reading it alongside, you know, 12 really smart college kids, just really living with Orwell for a good long while this year. And so
is that a specific collection of essays or just loose leaf essays?
No, there's a number of good collections. There's a standard one that you'll most likely find in the bookstores right now. It's just called Essays by George Orwell. There's a nice collection put together by George Packer, especially his narrative nonfiction. But, you know, you can also even look them up online. I mean, some of my favorites are Politics in the English Language, Shooting an Elephant, was the most famous. You know, Mara Cash, Looking Back at the Spanish War, Reflections on Gandhi, Notes on Nationalism, which I think is the most underread, really interesting one. There's a way of speaking truth about his time in an inconvenient way and a principled way that is just deeply beautiful to read for any reader and deeply inspiring for any writer.
What's a book that you found disappointing in the last 12 months?
I'm going to give a controversial answer here. I love Ishiguro. I love Remains of a Day. I love some of his novels about Japan, like Artist of a Floating World. I enjoyed Never Let Me Go. I somehow was disappointed by Clara and the Sun. I enjoyed it. I don't regret reading it, but something about it for me didn't quite work in ways that I can't entirely express. There was a sort of, I left it thinking I need a little pause from Ishiguro before going back to him.
You're not the first person to say that to me. So, interesting answer. What single book would you take to a desert island?
The Leopard by
Lampedusa.
By Lampedusa, thank you. I think the best political novel, the best novel about historical change, the best novel about how to come to terms with a changing world in which you'd no longer quite have a place. The best novel about the clash between a benevolent older person and a young person who's taking over his role and place in the world. So many beautiful themes in that novel. And, you know, if you're stuck on an island somewhere, you may as well, you know, read about the beautiful landscape of Sicily and, you know, the good food in Italy.
And finally, what book changed your mind?
You know, this is a very different book from the others I've mentioned. I came across a book called The Happiness Curve by Jonathan Rauch, who's a great journalist, winner of a National Magazine Award. And it's not the kind of book I tend to read. It's sort of, it isn't a self-help book, but it sort of nearly seems like it's in a kind of self-helpy category. But I found it to be deeply insightful. The argument of a book based on a lot of academic research is that happiness and life satisfaction have this kind of U-shape curve. You know, you're happy in your 20s and 30s often, you're often less satisfied in your 40s, and then it sort of goes back up. And actually, by the 60s and 70s, you're more satisfied than you were in your 20s and 30s. And as somebody who's recently had my 40th birthday, I found that it helped me understand a little bit of perhaps changes in myself, but also to put them in perspective, to say, hey, it's not that my character has changed or I tend to be a pretty happy-go-lucky person, but somehow I've sort of lost myself. This is an expectations gap that is quite typical that Rauch describes. And there's something to look forward to, actually, once you get through that temporary trough. So that's changed my mind in an interesting way about a very different kind of topic.
That's all we have time for, but thank you so much for your time. And a reminder to our listeners of the two great books you've written, very interesting books, The Great Experiment, and the latest book is The Identity Trap. Both fascinating books, and thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Charles.
His favorite book that I never heard of was Darkness at Noon by Arthur Koestler, published in 1940. I'd actually heard about it, and I have read it, and it's a fantastic book about the perils of totalitarianism. It's about an old Bolshevik who gets caught up in Stalin's purges of the 1940s and has time to think about the ideology while he's in prison. The book that he loves but just can't recommend to others was The Half-Girlfriend by Chetan Bhagat, published in 2014. It's a young romance novel by a best-selling, very commercial Indian author, and he really appreciated it because it gave him so many insights into the socioeconomic aspects of India. The best book that he read in the last 12 months was Essays by George Orwell, a collection of his nonfiction writing on all sorts of subjects. The book that he found disappointing in the last 12 months was Clara and the Sun by Katsuo Ishiguro, published in 2021, which is about a dystopian society where an AI befriends a young child. The book that he would take to a desert island was The Leopard by Giuseppe Tomasi di Lampedusa, published in 1958, about the changes in Sicilian society brought about by modern times and the unification of Italy. And finally, the book that changed his mind was The Happiness Curve by Jonathan Rauch, published in 2018, about the evolution of happiness in people as they get older. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Lit with Charles. If you have any suggestions or comments, you can always DM me on my Instagram account, @LitWithCharles. I try to reply to all my DMs. If you enjoyed this episode, you should definitely subscribe or follow me, and more importantly, tell your friends and family.